Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we start the program today by talking about our state parks, forest, and recreation areas. Those in southwestern Wisconsin we're going to zero in on today. This is the first in a series of conversations on the 125th anniversary year of the Wisconsin State Park System. To begin the show, a couple of guests for you. Jim Buchholz, a retired state park supervisor for the Wisconsin DNR. He's the author of this great book, Wisconsin State Parks, Forests, and Recreation Areas, A Ranger's Guide. Jim Buchholz, welcome back.
Glad to be with you again, Larry.
Thank you so much for joining in. Also with us, Jim Carter. Jim's the DNR property supervisor for Devil's Lake State Park and Natural Bridge State Park. Jim, great to have you with us as well.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for having me.
As we talk with our two guests, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Have you visited state parks in this area of the state? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Well, Jim Buck, I'll start with you. 1900, 125 years ago, Interstate State Park on the St. Croix River in Polk County became our first official state park. And Wisconsin was the first state to create a state park. This is a significant accomplishment, I think.
Well, we were. Actually, we started earlier. We tried to do it earlier, about 20 years earlier. We tried to start a state park. It didn't quite work out, so we had to wait till 1900 to get our first state park. And it was Interstate, as you mentioned, but Minnesota also has an interstate state park. That's why it's called Interstate. And they're right across the St. Croix River from each other. So dual gathering together of the two state parks, and what a great way to start the state park system.
Absolutely. And in your book, which I really am enjoying, Wisconsin State Parks, Forests, and Recreation Areas, A Ranger's Guide, it details all 80 of our state properties. I got about 500-page book, but it's a handy size. And you've divided the state into three regions. And today we're going to focus on Region 2, which is in the southwest portion of the state. What stands out to you about the parks in that area of our state?
Well, Region 2 in my book is the southernmost park, southwestern part of the state, and it's got the most state parks of all the regions that I covered. There's over 30 state parks and forests in that particular area, and so many of them are clustered right around Madison. So people in Madison, certainly in that area, have a lot to choose from, that's for sure, not to mention Devil's Lake, where Jim's going to be talking about in a little while, but Governor Dodge State Park, Wyalusing State Park way along the Mississippi River, and so many more, including Yellowstone, which we'll talk about later as well.
You know, I looked through that list of 30, and I counted 21 out of the 30 that I visited. So I've been to Aztalan, Belmont, Black River, Capitol Springs, Cross Plains, Devil's Lake, Governor Dodge, Governor Nelson, Lake Eganza, Lower Wisconsin State Riverway, the McKenzie Center, Mill Bluff, Mirror Lake, Nelson Dewey, I'm reading down the list here, Perot, Rocha Cree, Rocky Arbor, Tower Hill, Wyalusing, and Yellowstone.
you could have written this book.
Well, some of those I spent were really early on. Tower Hill, for example, on my eighth grade graduation trip.
Well,
we took a bus. I think there were about 15 of us. We took a bus to Tower Hill. So
nice.
That's a
nice.
Long time ago, and I think I've been back only once since. But I have some fond memories just from that eighth grade trip. And I've spent a lot of, I've made a lot of trips to Devil's Lake State Park. Jim Carter, you've been there since, well, 2020, I think you served as DNR supervisor for Devil's Lake State Park. And it's our most visited state park, is it not?
It is. It's the largest state park in Wisconsin, and it's also the busiest. Yes, we see about 2.4 million visitors annually at this park. So, yeah.
So, and I've been there many times and stayed there many times. What is it, in your mind, what is it that attracts so many people to Devil's Lake?
I think, you know, one thing that we're pretty rich in here is unique geology. You know, 500-foot bluffs rising above this 360-acre clear blue lake. I think there's nothing that attracts people like water. And then to have those rock formations towering above the lake and sandy beaches on both the north and the south shore, it's a very popular place to picnic and bring your friends and family.
You know, it was interesting to me, the sort of the history, the natural history, and how that lake was formed.
Yeah, I mean, this is some of the oldest rock in the state. The geology here, like I said, is quite rich. The quartzite rock, you know, was loose sand that was compressed over millions of years to give us these rock formations. And then the glaciers, which came along and blocked up the two ends and then receded and closed off this water body that we have here.
Yeah, it's really cool. Jim Buchholz, you once had Jim Carter's job at Devil's Lake. How does the park today compare to the park during your time working there?
Well, I wasn't the superintendent. I was an assistant manager there back in the old days, 1979 to 1983. So 5 years spent there before I went on to Wyalusing State Park as the manager there. But the nice part is you go back and it's just like coming home to me. A lot of the parks are that way, but to see the lake and to see the towering bluffs, as Jim mentioned, it's just fantastic to go back there. And even though it's the busiest park in the state, I mean, you go on most of these trails, and yeah, it can be busy at times, but there's so many places that you can go to, you know, have the whole, it seems like you have the whole park to yourself. So that hasn't changed, really. So.
Yeah, I agree. I don't even know how many trips I've made there. That's going back to my high school days for sure. And many times over the years since then. You know, there are effigy burial mounds within the park, and certainly evidence that Native American peoples live there. How far back, and maybe, I don't know, Jim Carter, maybe you can talk about this, a little of the history of the Native American peoples who live there.
Well, I can touch on it just briefly. You know, some of the first people at the lake probably date back more than 10,000 years. So besides even the First Nations that were around this area, the mound builders that built those mounds date back, you know, that long ago. Most of that evidence is on the North Shore. There's a cluster of mounds, some in the shape of animals and some in linear mounds and conical mounds. But most of those sites, yeah, are throughout our North Shore picnic area, and then probably the largest one is down on the South Shore, and that's what's referred to as the Bird Mound down there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's great to see. And European immigrants, I think, established the city of Baraboo, or the community of Baraboo, back in the 1850s.
Yeah, and what really brought tourism to this area was the railroad. So hotels and the railroad between the 1860s and 70s really drove, you know, the population and the interest in this property.
Yeah, I would think so. I bet a lot of people traveled there by train. And in the, what is it, the 1930s, thereabouts, the Civilian Conservation Corps had a camp at Devil's Lake. What did the Corps build at the park?
So the Corps built many of the stone buildings that you see today. So the park headquarters were my offices, some of our shower buildings that are still in use today in the Northern Lights campground. Those buildings are still used and were built back in the 30s by the CCC. That camp was actually down where our group camp is on the South Shore, off of the South Shore, actually, to the east towards 113. And, yeah, to have that amount of history along with our geology, it's fascinating to be able to come here and see that.
Yeah, it is indeed. You know, I was thinking one of the times I was there camping with a friend who had a small tent, and it was a decent evening, couple of evenings. And so rather than sleep with him in that small tent, I just slept outside on the grass next to the tent, and I got to observe a fair amount of wildlife, especially raccoons, during the course of the evening. But you can see a range of wildlife there, can't you, Jim?
Yes, you can. Yeah. Most of the wildlife that we have here is what you can see across most of the states, and we've even had a few bear sightings down here in the south.
Yeah. And Jim Buchholz, you were going to add to that?
Well, I was going to add earlier, even before the park was there, Devil's Lake, you know, has always been a popular place. The resorts that were built there, especially like Jim had mentioned, was put a line just for the resorts. And that was like in the 1870s, way before the park was there. And we had national celebrities. Ulysses S. Grant was there. Mary Todd Lincoln was there. Just had a steamboat on the lake for the tourists. So it would have been interesting to see what that looked like back in those days.
It would have been, indeed. Oh, man. And Jim Buchholz, which trail at Devil's Lake is your favorite? Do you have one?
Oh, I do. Yeah, the East Bluff Trail, it's called. You start on the north end of the park, and the East Bluff Trail starts there. And it's a pretty, you know, I wouldn't say it's an easy road, but it's not that bad. You go up and you go past different rock formations. There's Elephant Rock and Elephant Cave. And it leads to the iconic scene that you see in all magazines and calendars. Devil's Doorway is the most iconic and photographed rock probably in the Midwest, I bet. But that place, you can get to that. And then on the way down, you can either go back down the way you came, or if you want to walk a little further, you can loop around the lake, which I like to do. And that's about 4.7 net, closer to 5 miles, I guess it is, around the lake. So if you want to walk that far and take your time doing it, you can go down the Balanced Rock Trail or the Pothole Trail, all of which were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps, which we just talked about. And they're still there, and they're still maintained. And I know Jim has crews that go up there and maintain those. And sometimes there's a washout or a fallout, but go all the way down to the South Shore and then around and come back either on the West Bluff, or you can take the Tumble Rocks Trail, which goes right along the shoreline, which is a real easy route as well. So that would be my suggestion if people have time to walk it. That's the, I think, one of the best trails in the park.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And there are some other sites in the area that's certainly worth visiting. Parfrees Glen State Natural Area, that is not a very long hike, but it is a beautiful hike, Jim Buchholz.
Oh, it certainly is. Yeah, that I would often recommend that to people. It's not that hard of a trail. It's a short interpretive trail. It's actually, it's off of County DL, I guess, which stands for Devil's Lake. I'm not sure. About 2 miles east of Highway 113. And it's a separate area, has a separate parking area. and you follow a really beautiful cold running stream through, and it goes through a deep gorge that's lined with towering sandstone walls, and they're all embedded with quartzite stones, and it's kind of a magical place. I think if you have a chance to go and see it, I definitely would recommend anybody go.
Yeah, nice place to visit on, especially on a hot day, because it's usually cool in there.
It is, yeah.
And then, of course, Circus World in a museum in Baraboo is nearby as well, and that's always a fun visit. David called, couldn't stay with us, wanted to know what state park programs exist for visitors who are disabled vets. Jim Buchholz, you...
Oh, I thought you meant at Devil's Lake? Or...
No, I think this is more a general question, sorry. You have that in your book, I believe, but go ahead and talk about it.
Well, I don't know anything specific for disabled vets, but for disabled visitors, there's, you know, pretty much every state park has got accessible trails. I think of the most outstanding has to be the accessible lookout tower at Peninsula State Park, which was, I think, a $2.7 million structure with a ramp that goes all the way to the top of a lookout tower as being the best. But even at Devil's Lake, there's several places that are accommodating for people who have any kind of impairment, including disabled each. Most of the parks have special campsites with electricity and set up for people in wheelchairs, for example. Most parks have accessible trails that they can go on. Maybe Jim can fill us in on what you have at Devil's Lake.
Yeah, Jim Carter, what about Devil's Lake?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, specific to the state park system, disabled veterans and both former POWs can apply for a fee waiver, and they can apply through that through our Parks Bureau. They start by getting that form from the state. You can pull that off of our state parks website. Their county veterans service office would fill that out on their behalf with their documentation, and then they can send that to the state parks bureau, and they can actually get free admission passes that way.
Very, very cool. And speaking of admission, just for anyone, how difficult is it to book a campsite at the park?
For Devil's Lake, it's rather difficult, depending on, especially if you're looking for the summer for our prime rates or weekends for that matter. So we have 11-month advance window, and I encourage everyone to book early as soon as they know they want to make their plans. But as Jim mentioned before, and you know, I'll mention this also, there are opportunities if you look off peak. So
yeah,
you can still manage to find a site.
And speaking of off peak, we're going to talk about Natural Bridge State Park, which is less traveled, I think, certainly less traveled than Devil's Lake State Park. We'll talk about that in just a second. Jim Buchholz, our guest, one of our guests today, he's written Wisconsin State Parks, Forest, and Recreation Areas, A Ranger's Guide. And Jim Carter, of course, is the manager of the property at Devil's Lake State Park and also Natural Bridge State Park. And you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about our wonderful state parks here in Wisconsin, celebrating 125th anniversary this year. Jim Buchholz, one of our guests, has written this wonderful guide to Wisconsin state parks, A Ranger's Guide, and includes all of the 80 parks in our state. And we're zeroing in. He has three regions in his book, and we're zeroing in on Region 2 today, which is South Central and Southwestern Wisconsin. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. And Mark in Green Bay, I think he wanted to chime in on the free passes for disabled veterans. Mark, we do offer some free passes.
Yeah, hey, Larry, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to throw that tidbit of information out there that the state does offer free annual park passes to certain disabled veterans. There's a whole level system that goes into that that rating system, but that is one benefit the state offers for access.
Yeah, it does indeed. Mark, thank you for calling. Skip in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Skip.
Hey, hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, singing the praises of Tower Hill, mainly, and the sad state of its maintenance.
Oh, maintenance issues. Well, Jim Buckles, you want to address maintenance for our parks?
Sure. Yeah. First of all, I give credit to Jim Carter and all the managers that work with Steve Schmelzer, who's the director of the state parks, and it's amazing what they can do, given the reductions that they've had over the years, not only in personnel, but budgets as well. So, and I agree, there's some places that really could use some help, and Tower Hill is one that I think could use some work. What's really great is having the friends groups of all these properties come in and help with the maintenance. That's just outstanding. So I don't know what the total is, but it's tens of thousands, I know, of hours of people coming in to help maintain the buildings, and many of them are retired people like me, want to help out in the park and do that. So I encourage people who are interested in Tower Hill especially, or any other park, to come in and help, and there's plenty to do, and they're welcoming the help doing that. But I think Steve Schmelzer, I remember he was quoted in some article a while back that the maintenance projects that are on hand right now, these are projects of things that need to be done, need to be fixed. It's now over $1 billion, not million, $1 billion. That's how far behind state parks are. So yeah, we definitely need some help with a lot of things, but they're doing what they can with the resources that they have. That's the best I can come up with, I guess.
Yeah. Skip, thank you very much for calling. Jim Carter, I want to turn to Natural Bridge State Park, which I haven't visited. It's one of the 10 in this region that I haven't visited. Tell us about that park, which far fewer people actually visit.
Yeah, so one of the unique features there is the, where it gets its name, is the actual sandstone arch or the bridge. And unlike the rock here, that's a sandstone structure. It was created from wind and water erosion rather than the glacier, so it's just at the edge of the driftless area. So where the glaciers came through here by Devil's Lake and just kind of stopped, formed the lake, they didn't actually destroy the bridge over there. And that bridge structure, we have some archaeologists from back in the day that actually did some excavations, and they figure that from carbon dating that Native American people at the time go back about 11 years. They were using that bridge, and then there's almost like a shelter, like a somewhat of a cave.
About 11,000, about 11,000 years, you mean, not 11.
Yes, I'm sorry, 11,000 years, yep.
So it traces back, and Jim Buckles, you got a nice photo of it in the book, that bridge.
Yeah, that came into being in 1973, I started at Devil's Lake a few years later, so we didn't have enough rangers to really check that area out because it's about 20 miles away. I think it's about 20, if I recall right, Jim, from the Devil's Lake. So I would have to go out there about once a week during the summer just to make sure things were okay. And we had a local guy that kind of looked after it. But the really interesting thing, I think, not only the stone, natural stone arch, which is extremely rare in Wisconsin, very, very rare, and it's certainly the largest one that we have, but the excavation that they did there, and then as Jim had mentioned, 11,000 years ago, there were people there hunting. The excavation, they came up with clamshells and some 50 different animal species. And I kind of go through that in the book, but there were turkey, elk, wolf, bobcat, even mountain lions and passenger pigeon. All that has been identified there. But the neat thing to me is that they were using that overhang or that cave as a shelter at the same time that there were still glaciers over most of Wisconsin. As Jim mentioned, the glacier stopped and was stopped right at the Devil's Lake area. So this area was in the driftless area. So it was never crushed by the glacier. But to imagine that there were people here hunting all these animals and birds were here at the same time we had glaciers in Wisconsin, it kind of blows your mind when you think about it.
It does indeed. Well, Jim Carter, how do you divide your time between Devil's Lake and Natural Bridge State Parks?
Well, as you know, the previous caller had asked, funding is always an issue for us. So obviously, Devil's Lake, we oversee some of the smaller properties like Natural Bridge around us. Our staff is assigned to those. But we have to be strategic and prioritize, you know, where we spend that time. And unfortunately, Natural Bridge doesn't get as much time as you know, a larger, busier property like Devil's Lake, but it's always something we're working on that as best we can.
Yeah. Joe in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Yes, sir.
What's on your mind?
Well, I think Devil's Lake State Park is a real jewel, and there was that old ammo plant to the south. Has that been joined to the park?
Okay, the old ammunition plant south of Devil's Lake. Well, let's see. Jim Carter, do you have any information on that?
Yeah, you bet. So that property was divided among three different land owners. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has about just over 3,000 acres, and that's part of the Sauk Prairie State Recreational Area. And then the other landowners are the Ho-Chunk Nation and then the U.S. Dairy Research, Dairy Forage Research Center.
Yeah, so it got sort of divided up three ways. It took a while to get all that taken care of. If I'm thinking back in my history, I forget what year that was that officially became the case.
Yeah, it was a long time coming. I started my career here at the park in 2000, and I had heard about it for quite a while. But it wasn't until, I believe, 2016 or so that most of the land transfers actually happened.
Yeah, I can remember talking about it on this show at least 2016, but I think even earlier than that, we were talking about the as the conversation developed along the way, we kept track of it here on this program a little bit. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Mike in New London. Your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess the main point, you know, and it's been brought up on the show, but with the GOP legislature and the governor for a while in control, I mean, they defunded all these support programs for maintenance and upkeep and, as far as I'm concerned, improvement at all these state parks. I just don't understand why the people of this state, with as much as they love these parks, tolerate that. It's incredible.
Well, I don't know. Jim Buchholz, I'll turn to you. You're retired.
I don't understand it either. It used to be when I started, back in 76 or so, at that time it was still 50, what they call 50-50, the Wisconsin state park system, at least, not necessarily the state forest system, but the state park system at that time. There was a requirement, or the plan was for many, many years, it would be 50-50. They would get 50% of operating from taxes, property taxes, and it was 50% was, you know, camping fees, sticker admission fees, and that sort of thing. And that went on for many, many years, and gradually that was reduced more and more and more, and now we're at a point where that doesn't even exist anymore. So the state parks are attempting to run the whole thing basically with admission fees. So what happens? Well, admission fees go up, camping fees go up, out-of-state fees go up, and honestly, it's not enough. And I agree with the caller that it's something needs to be done. We're Wisconsin, if we're not at the bottom, we're at close to the bottom of all the states in the union for support for their state parks coming from taxes or from the sales.
Jim Carter, you probably have pretty good idea of how your park, with as many visitors as you have, probably do pretty well. Do you get to use all that money, or does it get spread out among other parks as well?
So, yeah, we do bring in a lot of revenue, but as Jim, you know, writes in his book, it's a system of state parks, so that money is actually divided across the system. So even though we may, you know, generate millions of dollars here at Devil's Lake, that money is spread out across the system of state parks. But to the caller's point, I mean, I won't touch on politics, but that's why we kind of look to our partners as much as possible. And here at Devil's Lake, we have two very active and strong partner groups. One is the Friends of Devil's Lake State Park, who do a lot of volunteering work and fundraising for us. And then they also can apply for grants. And then it's also the Devil's Lake Concession Corporation, which runs our concessions programs here. They're a nonprofit, and anything that they profit from, it gets turned back into the park here. So,
in the switch gears a little bit here, in the chapter about Wyalusing State Park, Jim Buchholz, you wrote about Treasure Cave. Supposedly, the crew of a boat of French fur traders went ashore and hid gold coins in the cave to prevent their theft by Sauk warriors. It's said that a rock slide blocked the entrance and the treasure is still buried there. This is in an email. Is there any truth to this story?
Well, that's the legend, and that's how it's been written down, and I'm still looking for it myself. So. I was the manager there from 83 to 86, so I had a chance to explore a lot of that area, and I can tell you I never found it, but it's a great story, and it may or may not be true like a lot of legends are, but that's how it got its name. So they say when it comes to legends, there's always a little hint of truth to it.
Gail in Tomahawk called, couldn't stay with us, but said they really enjoy Natural Bridge State Park, thinks it could use a bit more maintenance, but also said they wish the state trail passes were a card and not stickers that must be placed on the windshield. And my windshield, you know what I do? I kind of cheat, and I leave a corner of that sticker open, and that makes them easier to get off. Otherwise, I'd have my whole windshield covered with them. But I don't know. The stickers, well, what do you think? Has there ever been thought to that, Jim Carter?
So, I mean, we just went through a change right now, so we're going to a 12-month sticker program rather than an annual. So there are some advantages for users in that regard. We are looking at other options. Some states do registration tied to their vehicle registration, but we're nowhere near enacting that quite yet. So it'll probably remain the sticker for the short term.
And Nick in Edgerton has a question or a comment. Nick, hi.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the call. My parents still live in my childhood home, and I grew up where the Yahara River comes out of Lake Kiganza. And to the south side of the neighborhood was an inlet, and my childhood friends and I, we'd ice skate there and canoe there and build forks. But then right around the corner was the Lake Kiganza State Park. And once we got old enough and had multi-gear bikes and our parents trusted us enough, we would bike ride down to Lake Kiganza State Park. And I can't tell you, there's no better way for a kid to grow up than in that type of an environment with those experiences to have. And then one of my favorite memories with Lake Kiganza State Park was the candlelit cross-country ski night.
Oh, yeah. Jim Buchholz, maybe you can talk about that a bit. But those nights, those adventures at night, not only at Lake Kiganza but elsewhere, are really, really a lot of fun.
Yeah, the candlelight kind of started out as candlelight skis. Most properties that had ski trails would put out those on, with the help of volunteers, of course, because that's quite a operation to do, to put out hundreds of candlelight candles. And we used tiki torches actually at Kohler Andry. But you know, given the warming of the atmosphere, a lot of them end up being a hike, which is okay too. Sometimes we did both. You have one area where they could ski and another one where they could hike. I know Harrington Beach did that. They had one area where you could hike right next to the ski trail, which is a good idea. But, yeah, they're a lot of fun. And quite a few parks do summer ones now as well, candlelight summer hikes.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, Lake Kiganza is a great park. That's one of my favorites to go to as well, and most people don't know it actually started out as a roadside rest stop back in the 60s when they started the interstate system. They had to have so many places where they could have pullover areas, and that's how it got started actually. But it became so popular because it was right on Lake Kiganza, of course, and it was a beautiful area. So it didn't last long. It became a state park soon after. It became a wayside, you'd say.
I have many, many hours of fishing and fun at that park. Nick, and thanks again for joining in. Appreciate it. And tell you what, thanks a lot, Jim Carter, for all you do for Devil's Lake State Park and the Natural Bridge State Park. It's been a pleasure talking with you today, and I hope we have a chance to visit again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me on the show. Have a good day, guys.
You have a great day as well. Well, we're going to welcome in Michael Degenhart next. Michael is the property supervisor for Yellowstone Lake State Park and Belmont Mound State Park and Caddis Springs State Park. State Recreation Area, and that'll be coming up next. We'll visit with Michael, and Jim Buchholz going to stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our state park system, 125 years old this year, and so we're talking about it today and zeroing in on one area of the state, the south central and southwestern region of Wisconsin that contains about 30 state parks. And joining us now, along with Jim Buchholz, is Mike Degenhart. Mike is DNR property supervisor for Yellowstone Lake State Park, Belmont Mound State Park, and Caddis Springs State Recreation Area. Mike, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for coming to the studio. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me here. It's a real privilege to be on your show.
Well, I tell you what, I'm really looking forward to what you have to say here. Before we get to you, I want to go to Jan in Beaver Dam because she wanted a comment about Devil's Lake. And so, Jan, we'll go to you.
Thank you, Larry. Good morning. As a child in the 50s, we had a cottage up at Devil's Lake on the North Shore. And we had many, many wonderful summers up there. And we'd go into Baraboo as well. And we had the Chateau, just so many memories where we'd climb up to Devil's Doorway, Elvis Rock, all those places. So, and then they, you know, all the cottagers were gone, were asked to leave. But those were wonderful days when we had the cottages on the North Shore.
Jan, thanks for calling. And Jim Buchholz, you might probably know a little of the history of that.
Yeah, the state bought out most of those cottages. Not all, there's still a few there. And the people who owned those cottages were allowed to stay at those places for that generation. And after that, they would relinquish their use of the cottage and make it part of the state park. One of them, interesting enough, was belonged to the Ringling Brothers of the Ringling Brothers Circus. They had a summer home on the West Bluff area. And I guess during that period, up until 1918, it wasn't unusual to see the Ringling Brothers would bring their circus elephants to the lake to give them a wash. I actually found a photograph of that, which was mislabeled as being in Michigan, but it's a beautiful, neat picture of actually African elephants, two of them with a trainer in Devil's Lake with the East Bluff in the background. So that would have been something to see elephants in the state park.
Jan, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Let's talk about Yellowstone Lake State Park, which I first visited, now it's a long time back, Mike Dagenhart. I had a three-year-old and a five-year-old, two kids, Carolee and Diane, and my wife, and we camped there. But I can get into my own stories about that, but this park, including the lake, were intentionally built, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, the lake was built in 1954. Planning for that started a few years earlier. You know, it's kind of a neat history because working there, you have a lot of local families that'll come and tell you that my grandpa had this portion of farm field over here, which is kind of neat with the history of building of the dam. And then it was 1970 before it officially became a state park. Had a campground before that and was ran by the state prior to that, but officially in 1970.
I remember the camp area was up on a hill and up on a high hill, and then there was a camp inn. You could walk into the woods and there were camp sites. And I was new at camping with the kids. And so we went to one of the sites where you went into the woods, and I didn't have enough mosquito repellent. it was probably the height of the mosquito season, and we couldn't stay as long as I would have liked.
Yeah, we still have 128 campsites up on top of the hill and six group sites. It's a little, over the years, it's kind of it's more wooded now of a camping area.
It was wide open at that time, that open area, and I don't think there were any sites there available, so we went into the wooded area, and I could then see why people wanted to be out in the open area.
Yeah.
Nice views from up there. Tell us a bit more about the park itself.
Oh, the park has the main feature of the lake is over 450 acres. It's kind of an interesting lake because it has so many different draws for so many different visitors.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the only lakes in the area that has motorized boat traffic on it. A lot of southern Wisconsin doesn't have that. So people travel there for water recreation, you know, mainly weekend use of tubers and skiers, jet skiers a little bit. And we also have quite a few people going there for fishing. And it's an interesting fishing lake because it has a little bit of everything. And I'll have visitors tell me that they like to come there to go bass fishing. But I'll also have the next visitor in will be, this is my favorite fish place to panfish. And then in the fall, we'll get musky fishermen in there. The lake also has, you know, the non-motorized sports that go on. Friends groups just is just finishing up a project on a kayak launch on the west end, where a lot of people like to kayak canoe from and head up the river.
Yeah, it's a really neat place. And I was thinking of, I caught a lot of panfish and some northern, and there were a few northern at least in there, if I'm not mistaken. I tried muskies. I didn't have any luck with muskie, but I caught an awful lot of panfish with the kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this last spring, ice fishing is kind of starting out slow this year for us with the ice, but last spring was really good for panfish, and it seemed like muskies and walleyes were fairly good in the spring and fall, too. So.
Yeah. Jonah in Green Bay has something. Let's go there. Hi, Jonah.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was wondering about the incoming Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Scott Turner, and his signaled support for buying up federal land, or at least, actually, it's rather selling federal land to private builders. Do you guys know if Wisconsin's state constitution protects our own land from any federal overreach like that?
For state parks and so forth. Jim Buchholz?
I'm not familiar with the federal section. Statewide, unfortunately, you might say, there are cases where the state is allowed to trade land or sell land. And sometimes it's fine because there's isolated parcels of land that are not connected or part of a property. But then there are other places, my former park where I work, Kohler Andrew State Park, for example, there was a trade-off in sale, not sale, but a trade of land that occurred given the Kohler Company the right to take part of the state park for use in developing their golf course there, which is still very controversial. It's been delayed now 9 years, and there's active groups trying to prevent that from happening, but apparently that can happen. There's other areas, Red Mountain State Park, for example, is another one where the downhill ski area, another controversial one where they took land quite a few acres away to build another ski run. So that, again, took land away from the state for that thing. So there's some of that. As far as the federal, I can't talk about that. I'm not sure about that.
We're talking with Jim Buchholz and with Michael Degenhardt. Michael is DNR property supervisor for Yellowstone Lake State Park and Belmont State Park, Belmont Mound, I should say, State Park, and Caddis Springs State Recreation Areas. And they are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. Somebody called in and wondered about the phone number for Devil's Lake State Park Visitor Center. And that phone number is 608-356-8301. 608-356-8301. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News. And then we'll be back with Jim Buchholz and Mike Degenhardt. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today. You know, there are large and there are small state parks dotting all across Wisconsin's landscape, and many of the smaller parks kind of get overlooked despite being beautiful places with unique histories. And we're talking with a couple of knowledgeable guys about our state parks. One of them, Mike Degenhart, is the DNR property supervisor for Yellowstone Lake State Park, for Belmont Mound State Park and Caddis Springs State Recreation Areas. Jim Buchholz, he's going to be with us for all of our celebrations here of the state park system over the next several months. He's filling in, and he, why? Because, well, he wrote Wisconsin State Parks, Forest and Recreation Areas, A Ranger's Guide, and it's a really dandy book. So it's great to have both Mike and Jim with us today, and callers online, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tell us a little more about Yellowstone before we take phone calls, Mike. Maybe you can talk more about Yellowstone. We've talked about the camping and the sights to see. There's some trails, hiking trails, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we have 8 miles of trails, you know, and they kind of vary in terrain. We have the Oak Grove Trail, which is probably one of my favorite trails. Kind of does the rolling hills of the Driftless area, up through some nice oak forest, yeah, through a ravine. It's really a nice trail. On cooler, not sunny days, I like the Prairie Trail and the Prairie Savannah Trail, which has a lot of prairie area around it, about 180 acres of prairie that's mainly maintained by volunteers and volunteer work, with some help from the state natural area people too. But we have some really dedicated prairie enthusiast members that work there and just make that trail beautiful with the flowers. One of the trails that's probably highly used is we have 4,000 acres of wildlife area around, yeah, around the property. And one of the trails by our office, the Wildlife Loop, is a highly used trail. We kind of cooperatively, we maintain the trail for people. It's a level trail. Starts out by the office, kind of goes on. It's on a earthen dam that was a retaining pond for fisheries in the early history. So in the spring, when you go out walking around that, you see a lot of ducks, geese that are nesting will kind of harass you. The far corner, when you just get to the river and the lake where they meet, across the river is an eagle nest. That's a popular place to watch. The trail loops around and comes back to the office through some wetland area of, you know, the southern Wisconsin wetland with there's a disabled, an accessibility duck blind there for people that have accessibility needs, which is in kind of rough shapes, but it's in the works to have a project done to make that trail into a universal trail and upgrade that duck blind. So it's one of those things that's years out, but the trail's so loved that I'm really excited about that.
Really cool. You mentioned handicapped accessibility and so forth. I believe Stella in Sturgeon Bay has a question relating to that, maybe not for your area, but another area. Stella, what's on your mind?
Yeah, it's not a question. Somebody called in earlier and was asking about accommodations at the state parks for handicapped veterans, and then it was taken to handicapped in general. I just wanted to mention that in Door County here, we have 5 state parks, and Peninsula State Park has a track chair, which is a wheelchair but doesn't have wheels. It has tracks like a tank.
Yep.
And it can operate over terrain that a wheelchair can't possibly operate over, and that is available for handicapped individuals to check out and use on the trails in Peninsula State Park. I believe that there is one other state park in the county here that has one also, and the goal is to get one, at least one for each state park here. And they they have been provided by individuals providing the funds to purchase them.
Yeah. Stella, thanks a lot for calling. And we'll certainly in a future show, we'll be zeroing in on that particular area of the state. But just handicapped accessibility, Jim Buchholz, you want to comment?
Well, in regard to the caller, yeah, those vehicles are at many of the major state parks have their own right now, and it'd be great if all of them would have them. If they don't have them themselves, they're usually available through their county or through the conservation associations. A lot of them have been purchased, and you can get them and use them and bring them to a property. So even if a property doesn't have one, those tracked vehicles, basically you just plug them in and charge them up, and then you can use them. I've actually used them. I used one myself when I had an individual at the Kohler Andry, that had one and let me try it out, and they're really neat. I mean, they're easy to use. They go over just about any kind of terrain, and I think it's going to be something in the future that's going to be great.
Yeah, I would agree. They're a little pricey, which is why we don't have them probably in every park. Now, I don't know what the cost is. I've forgotten what the one would cost, but it's not a small amount of money.
Yeah, some of the parks, especially ones that have beaches, I should mention also that they have, push wheelchairs. They have big balloon tires on them, and they're made out of PVC pipe, and they're very comfortable. And people who are, confined to wheelchairs can use those. You need somebody to push you, but they're very easy to push. You can go over even sand dunes and down the beach, and they're really a lot of fun. And I think pretty much every NV park now who's got any kind of a size beach has those beach wheelchairs, and they're available free of charge. Just ask for them.
Mike, back to you for a bit on Yellowstone. I want to talk. How many people visit Yellowstone and Lake State Park in the course of a year?
Typically, we'll have just over 250,000 visitors a year.
Pretty good number.
Pretty popular, popular fishing, boating in the weekends.
Do you draw people from? I mean, I'm sure you draw a lot of people from that part of the state, but probably come from a lot of different places.
Yes, they come from from all over. A lot of visitors from out of state come to that property. We're close to the Illinois border, so we have a lot of visitors from Illinois. Iowa is not too far away, so.
Yeah, it's located near Blanchardville, the park itself is. So that, to give you kind of an idea of where it is in the state, and I'd say, 40 miles from Madison or so?
Yeah, about 40 miles from Madison, about a half hour from Platteville.
Well, Jim, your book says Yellowstone Lake State Park is home to more than 30 bat houses maintained by volunteers. Can we see them flying around? Probably flying around at night more often.
Well, that's actually a question I wanted to ask Mike, given that the white nose disease has really decimated the populations of bats. I guess my question is, are there still a lot of bats there at his property at Yellowstone?
Yeah.
That is one of the really fun success stories of volunteers. Kent Borchening and some of his companions started that up actually two superintendents ago. And I've heard the story of how he came into the office and had this idea and talked to him, and they on a whim thought, well, this sounds like it could work. Just before the white-nosed bat syndrome, we had around 4,500 on the fall count for bats. The numbers went down to about 10% of that afterwards. We're on the climb again, not significant enough that we could say this is some kind of major comeback, but we're up over 1,000 this fall when they counted. We usually count spring and fall, so that's good news. It's definitely a positive step, so we're hoping. Bats have been a big draw at the property. We have some major bat houses are located right by the amphitheater in the campground, and people would watch those in the evening, and in the morning when they either come out or the swarm coming back in is amazing too. So
very, very cool. And it is kind of heartening to hear. And I've heard this in some other areas too, where the numbers were way down and now they seem to be coming back a little bit. That is good news indeed. Louie in Dodgeville will give you a chance to join in. Louie, hi. Or is it Louise? I'm sorry. Louise.
That's okay. I have a question about Governor Dodge State Park. I know that there were several farm properties prior to the park, and I wondered if you had any information on the farming that happened there.
Jim, comment on that? I think you discussed that a little bit in your story about Governor Dodge, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that Governor Dodge State Park, the two lakes are man-made lakes there. And prior to those lakes being created, that entire area was basically a farming community. So when the state started out, this land that was actually donated by the county, and that was added on with some other donations, and eventually Governor Dodge ended up being like one of the largest state parks in the state. But that was a lot of farming area. A lot of that's been redone now into prairie land. So a lot of the land that was formerly cropland is now maintained as prairies. But the lower areas, the two lakes at the Governor Dodge State Park, Cox Hollow is probably the busiest, and that's where the campgrounds are located too now. So yeah, quite a transformation from a little farming area into one of the busiest parks in the state right now.
Yeah. I think it was corn, alfalfa, those kind of crops were grown at that before the park came in.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and some of the leftovers are kind of interesting because they have these natural springs, and they preserve the spring houses. One in particular is really an interesting one. It's next to Stephen Falls. If you take a trail down to Stephen Falls, which is something you should go see if you go to Governor Dodge.
Yeah.
And right on your way down there, and it's accessible. It's a paved route at least to the top of it, but along the route, you'll see a spring house there, and you can go inside of it, and it's, especially on a hot day, it's very nice and cool in there, but that's where they would keep their milk from the farming, those that had farm dairy cows. And anything else they wanted to keep cool, that's what it was for, the spring house, for keeping things cool.
Well, you're saying springs reminds me of another one of the parks that Mike's in charge of, Caddis Springs State Recreation Area. And it's your responsibility, Mike, to sort of oversee that area. Describe it for us.
That is one of the, a smaller park in the system. Which is interesting because I find that like the small parks are really fun to go to. If you talk to some of the visitors there, it won't take long to meet one of the locals that are in love with the area. That park, that rec area has two lakes on it, Beckman Lake and Sander. They're divided by earthen dam with a paved trail on it. There's a trail all the way around the lake. The lake is probably best known for its pan fishing, but it is a really good lake to take a kayak or a canoe out on. It's smaller, it's quiet.
Yeah.
There's a lot of waterfall to see.
You're not going to be water skiing on that one.
Nope, it's non-wake.
non-waker.
Yep.
So there are, and there's a recreation area, you know, and there's a state park. What differentiates a recreation area from a state park?
There's a little bit of difference even amongst the recreation areas, but Cadiz is open to hunting, so it would be just your normal hunting regulations for that. So that's kind of a mutual use property. There is some area that's closed around the day use portion of it. And all this information will be shown on our website, too, when you look it up on the hunting maps for our properties.
Well, I want to also make sure we talk about Belmont Mound State Park, because that's another one, Mike, that you are supervisor of Belmont State Park and Cadiz Springs State Recreation Area. And the Belmont Mound State Park, what do we see in that state park?
So that's one of the mounds outside of Platteville, the one past the one with the big M on it. The mound is made out of Niagara Dolomite, left over from, you know, didn't get hit by the glacier there. It is 1,400 feet. The property's about 260-some acres. And it is operated with cooperation with the Lions Club. They just have a new friends group that just started up just a few years ago. And there's a lot of enthusiasm, and they've done some great things. They have some programs that they're doing, a hike to the top of the mound coming up February 22nd. They're just finishing up a playground project, so it's really fun to see the enthusiasm of these friends groups and volunteers out there.
It really is. And you were assigned to Yellowstone, Belmont Mound, and Cadiz Springs, but you worked at other southwestern Wisconsin state parks. What have you come to appreciate about the driftless area of the state?
I really like the driftless area. There is a lot of different, each of the parks have their own features that probably are everybody's favorites, but they all have a little of something to offer to people. You know, and I think the parks themselves have a really friendly atmosphere, and there's a lot of local interest down here. And I think that is what keeps me in the area, is the excitement from the visitors and the friends groups and the other volunteers.
Yeah, it's really good. Dan in Fitchburg had asked about wildflowers and restoration projects within state parks. Is there any of that going on in your section, Mike, or maybe, and Jim could probably comment too in general?
For me, at the properties that I work at, Yellowstone has the Prairie Enthusiasts, which is a big statewide group, and they are really active there at Yellowstone and do a lot of nice work. And I can't say enough about all the good hard work they do. Countless hours they put in each year. They work also with the state natural area people in the prairie there at Yellowstone. And there is a prairie area over at Cadiz Springs that is worked on with the state natural area, and the friends group over there is starting to grow interest as they build after COVID. They kind of are making a comeback after COVID. And they show a lot of interest in future work in that area, too. So.
Yeah. Jim Buchholz, in general, a lot of that goes on, does it not?
It sure does, especially in regard to invasive species, removing of things like buckthorn and garlic mustard and many, many other ones that every park and forest I know has programs, and they get the public involved in removal, that volunteers, because obviously they don't have enough personnel to do it themselves, because we're talking acres, sometimes hundreds of acres. And that along with restoring prairies, or if there weren't prairies in the area, restoring the area to the native hardwoods, for example, in the Kettle Moraine area. They're gradually reducing, like, the evergreens, the the evergreens that were planted years ago, they really are not native to the Kettle Moraines, for example. So those are being transformed little by little into more native species.
We had Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin, who emailed to say Yellowstone Lake State Park is a wonderful park. Several species of orchids can be found growing there. Great crappie fishing in the lake. I can attest to that. I caught a lot of crappies there. Lots of bat houses in the camping area. Awesome birding. And an insane number of hummingbirds at the office feeder. Mike, would you agree with all that?
I would agree with all that and really appreciate his comments. Those are the things that make being at a state park and working there great is when you hear the comments about people having enjoying the resources there. So,
a listener emailed to ask, who do we contact to lobby for more state park funding? And Jim, I'll turn it to you for that.
Well, like most everything, you have to get a hold of your state representatives, your representatives and your state senators, and they're the ones that put together the budgets. And we're going through a budget cycle right now, which will be, going over different things in different directions. So funding for state parks is certainly one that deserves to be on the top of the list of the things that should be done, need to be done, and so supportive. It doesn't matter, if you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. I mean, everybody enjoys the state parks and want to see them continue to be improved and certainly be funded so people can continue to enjoy them, because it's the one. Really, it's the treasure of Wisconsin, and it always has been, and we've got to maintain it, and we've got to keep it available for people. So, let your representative know that you care about it and you want that to be funded.
Yeah, if you have a legislator, I mean, there's 80 state parks. If there's got to be legislators all over this, and there are legislators all over the state who have that, a state park in their area. And so I think it's a good idea to contact, if you're interested in getting lobbying for more funding, that would be a really good place to start, especially with those legislators that have state parks within their purview or within their home region. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Mike, I appreciate you driving over for this. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
It's great. Mike Degenhart is DNR Property Supervisor for Yellowstone Lake State Park, Belmont Mound State Park, and Cadiz Springs State Recreation Area. And Jim Buchholz, you're going to be back with us next month, aren't you?
I will certainly be back, yeah.
You know which region of the state we're going to deal with?
I do not. What are we going to do?
Well, I don't know either. I'm going to have to ask our producer, Joel, which one we're going to zero in on. We'll figure it out. There's two more areas that we got to cover, and we'll do it. So it'll either be the north area or it'll be the southeast area. One or the other. we'll figure that out. Thanks, Jim.
And, All right.
And pick up a copy of Jim's book. It's take a look at it. It's, if you're interested in the state parks at all, Wisconsin State Parks, Forests, and Recreation Areas. Brand new book. Jim Buchholz, the author. It's a ranger's guide, and it's packed with information about the 80 state parks and recreation areas that we have in the state. And speaking of recreation areas, coming up, we're going to take a look at one recreation area, the Sauk Prairie area, where we have Eagle Watching Days coming up. We'll talk about that in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thank you. You know, this time of year, bald eagles gather in the Sauk Prairie area, a lot of them in the trees overlooking the Wisconsin River, and every year, that's where the Bald Eagle Watching Days event occurs. Larry Mueller here. Prairie du Sac is hosting Bald Eagle Watching Days this coming weekend, January 18th and 19th. And we have a couple of guests with us today to talk about it. One of them, Jenny Lanzendorf, is a board member of the Ferry Bluff Eagle Council, serves as the chair of the Sauk Prairie Bald Eagle Watching Days organizing committee. And Jenny, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Also with us today, Richard Stephan, a zoologist, conservation biologist in natural heritage conservation for the Wisconsin DNR. And Richard, welcome to you. Thank you for joining in.
Yeah. Hey, Larry. Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you. As we talk with Richard and Jenny, I hope you'll join in. What do you know about bald eagles? Have you attended the Sauk Prairie Bald Eagle Watching Days, or do you plan to go this weekend? Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Richard, to start with you for a minute, how are bald eagles faring in Wisconsin these days?
Yeah, they're doing really, really well. Actually, it's kind of one of our exciting success stories. Their numbers have kind of leveled off now in the last few years, but we did nest surveys for them. And the current numbers are around over 1,700 nesting pairs in the state. And that's up tremendously from probably just about 50 years ago when the numbers were kind of at their lowest point in the early 70s, when they were down to only like around 100 nesting pairs in the state. So we've seen a really great kind of increase in their population and number of nesting pairs here in Wisconsin, which is really exciting. And then, yeah, we can kind of see those numbers show themselves in the winter, too, during events like this and other times of the year.
And for those who aren't familiar, why do bald eagles gather in that Sauk Prairie area this time of year?
Yeah, the main attraction is the open water, especially near the dam there in Sauk Prairie. And then also the surrounding forest really provides great roosting and protection from some of the elements, the cold and the wind. And then, yeah, so the open water is the main attraction, of course, it provides a food source for them, the fish that they can access, whereas a lot of the rest of the state is all iced over, including the rivers and lakes in the northern part of the state and other regions. So if you go near some of these dams or locks and some of these major rivers that are still open, you'll oftentimes be able to still find eagles this time of year. And then the combination of that with the really protective forests that surround the river really make for ideal winter roosting areas for eagles.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jenny, here we got Bald Eagle Watching Days this Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, that's right. We're really looking forward to putting on a great event again this year.
And tell us, I've been there many times for Eagle Watching Days. For those who haven't, what are we going to, of course, we're going to see eagles, but tell us about the whole event itself.
It's put on by a lot of volunteers. It's a great event. This is actually the 39th year that we've hosted Eagle Watching Days in the Sauk Prairie area. I haven't been there for all of them. This is my my fifth year being a part of the event, but it's really turned into a fantastic event. We have volunteers out there at the Overlook in Prairie du Sac, overlooking the river, that will help attendees see the eagles and be able to, you know, talk about what they're seeing and tell the adults from the immatures and things like that. And then we've also got a great lineup of presenters at the River Arts Center. We've got a live bird of prey show with Schlitz Audubon, and we've got some children's programming and just a lot of things going on there at the River Arts Center, and I'll be up there hosting that. And we've got some, like I said, some kids activities for the younger folks to come in and meet with some people and do some fun activities and maybe win some prizes. And we'll have a turkey vulture ambassador for a couple hours during the day at the River Arts Center, which is always a big hit to get to meet a turkey vulture, not an eagle, but similar to another great bird that we have along the Riverway. And we've got activities at the Ruth Culver Library, which is right there by the overlook as well. And at the Trip Museum, which is one of our co-hosts, the Trip Heritage Museum in Prairie du Sac, we're going to have Art and Don Chagone talking about Native American culture and eagles, how eagles figure into their culture as well.
So lots going on, and I'm just maybe some of the transportation part of it. Is there, I mean, in the past there have been ways that to get people from one place to another and parking and so forth. Can you talk about that?
In the past we have offered bus tours. We're not doing that this year. Logistically, that's just been sort of challenging for us. There is at the River Arts Center is by the, that's attached to the high school there in Sauk Prairie, and there's plenty of parking there.
Yeah.
And there's good parking along Water Street, and there's a parking lot there at the Overlook. We do have a self-guided tour that people can do on their own. So if you go to the Fairy Bluff Eagle Council website, there's a couple links to a couple tours that driving tours that people can go. And besides the Overlook, there's other great places to observe eagles. So that's something that people can do on their own from their own vehicle.
I was looking ahead to the forecast. The forecast doesn't look, it actually looks pretty good, if I think, for at least for Saturday. Maybe Sunday, yeah, too.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Yeah, so I should have said, so the events that we're having at the River Arts Center, those all are Saturday. Saturday's kind of our big day for the events, but we are going to have volunteers out there at the Overlook on Sunday as well. Even without volunteers, the Overlook's always a great place to come and see eagles.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there, what time do things start at the center and so forth?
We'll be starting at 9 o'clock. And so, and I should say for some of those activities that we're having at the River Arts Center, we do have tickets available. All the events are free, but we ask people to pick up a ticket from the Fairy Bluff Eagle Council table for the presentations at the River Arts Center. That helps us keep the numbers so that we don't overfill the River Arts Center.
Well, and there's a chance of that always, for sure. So think about those tickets. And tell us a little more about the Fairy Bluff Eagle Council. In addition to putting on this event, which is a big event, you're going to get a lot of people there. What does the organization do?
Fairy Bluff Eagle Council does a lot of work with the community around conservation and really protecting that habitat along the Lower Wisconsin River for eagles. We do some citizen science programs. So we do roost counts every winter. A number of volunteers, including myself, will go out, and eagles in the wintertime, they roost communally. So we've identified several roosts along the Riverway where dozens of eagles will fly in the evening. So we'll stand out in the cold at dusk and count them as they come in, and we can use those numbers to share that with the DNR and other scientific organizations that are helping to track those numbers. We work with the community on things like development along the Riverway to mitigate the impact to eagles, since eagles in the winter, they obviously come and feed along the riverway and roost, and we have the high numbers there, but we also have nesting eagles in the spring and summertime, and we want to limit the impact to that as well. So we can advise on development and you know, many things like that. We also do work on promoting the use of, for instance, copper bullets. Lead poisoning is such a huge issue with eagles eating, you know, eating deer carcasses and getting lead poisoning and becoming very sick. And that's been very impactful. So we have a program to offer some discounts on copper bullets at one of our local stores there as well.
And we're going to talk some more about that. I want to ask Rich Stafen some questions relating to eagles, maybe lead poisoning, but some other areas as well. If you have a question about either eagle watching days or about eagles themselves, I hope you'll join in with your questions. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about eagles and eagle watching days that's coming up this weekend with our two guests. Jenny Lansendorf is a board member of Ferry Bluff Eagle Council, as chairs the Sauk Prairie Bald Eagle Watching Days Organizing Committee. Rich Stafen is a zoologist and conservation biologist in natural heritage conservation for the Wisconsin DNR. So it's great to have both of them with us today. And again, you can join in. The numbers 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Rich, have you worked with the Ferry Bluff Eagle Council sort of in tandem when it comes to eagles?
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, helping, participating in the event that we're talking about today, Bald Eagle Watching Days, I've helped lead some of the bus tours that Jenny mentioned before, and manned a booth at the River Arts Center there. And then we definitely do use the information that they, from their roost, winter roost counts for bald eagles. We have a migratory bird or a bird concentration area layer that we keep track of. And we use that information from their roost counts to update those locations along the lower Wisconsin River and hopefully better protect those areas. So yeah, their data has been very helpful in protecting bald eagle populations around the state.
What are the biggest threats? Jenny mentioned, which got me thinking about it, the lead poisoning from, say, eating deer carcasses or whatever. But talk a bit about the threats to bald eagles.
Yeah, that's a big one, especially in the winter time. So like in December and January, so post gun deer season, lead poisoning is a major issue for them. Throughout the year, though, we also see eagles getting hit alongside the road. So if they're foraging on a carcass a deer carcass alongside of the road, when they try to leave or fly up, if they get startled and try and fly up from eating that carcass, they oftentimes can't get up into the air fast enough and get hit by cars. So that's an issue. So like one thing that people could do is if the deer doesn't, or the carcass doesn't get picked up quickly or timely, they could pull it off the side of the road a little bit further from the road to help give the eagles a little bit more runway to get airborne, which would be helpful. Another one is recently is avian influenza has really had an impact on nesting eagles and young. We've seen some decreases. 2 years ago, especially, was a really poor year for eagle productivity. So it was probably a combination of kind of a cold and wet spring, but then also the avian influenza was kind of rampant and really had a major impact on that year's young and some adult birds as well. So that's one that we're kind of monitoring going forward. The last couple of years haven't been as or nearly as bad with avian influenza, but there's signs that it could be rearing its head again in the future. So definitely keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, and there's not a lot. I mean, what efforts are we doing? There's not a lot you can kind of do about it, is there? The avian influenza?
Yeah, not a whole lot that we can do. Yeah, I think when the eagles are in close proximity to each other, they can spread it that way. So yeah, we're just trying to monitor impacts at this point and kind of minimize as best as we can. But yeah, there's not a whole lot that can be done at this point.
You know, when I go to eagle watching days, I always take a pair of binoculars along with me, and I use them to good effect. But I mean, you don't need a pair of binoculars to see the eagles there for sure. But that it's helpful. And there are some spotting scopes, are there not, if I'm not mistaken, along the river, Jenny?
Yeah, that's correct, Larry. We, you know, if you have binoculars, please bring them along. You can, it'll give you some better views of the eagles there. There is an island just outside the, or just on the river there opposite the overlook. It's called Eagle Island because it's such a popular roosting spot for eagles. We will have some spotting scopes there for folks to look through and, again, assist them with seeing those eagles. And, you know, I definitely encourage binoculars and scopes to get those up close views, but, the eagles are really right there. And, really, it's really something to see, but you don't need binoculars to see them, easily seeable with the naked eye.
You know, I don't think I've ever been there, but when I didn't see was at least a few people with some pretty long lens cameras. There, it's a photographer's kind of dream in a way, isn't it, Rich?
Yeah, for sure. When you can get that many eagles in close proximity to you, it is kind of a photographer's dream come true.
Yeah, and if you can't make the weekend, could you still see the bald eagles there through the winter, I would assume. I mean, you're just not going to have all of the help and assistance and all the other fun things that go on during eagle watching days.
Well, you know, we send out the invitation and so that the eagles will be there on that weekend, but they are there the rest of the season. And, you know, it's been a great season so far. We've been seeing really good numbers of eagles along the riverway, right, you know, since December. And we expect to, as long as the weather stays cold. And they're really putting on a great show for us this year. You get to see them feeding, you know, as the season progresses. Sometimes we get to see some of that courtship behavior, which is just really, really fun to watch the eagles interacting along the river. But yep, if you can't make it to Eagle Days, I'd still encourage you to come out and come along the river and see the eagles at any other day.
Some pretty good restaurants in that area too, if I can speak from experience on that. So it's always fun to watch and then maybe stop in at one of the local restaurants and have yourself a good meal. Ken in Monona has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ken.
Good afternoon. I think that we would be remiss without, I would like to say two different things. One is we should certainly mention Rachel Carlson and her 1962 book, Silent Spring. And that's a perfect example of how one person, one woman, changed the whole course of history in the pesticides. And so I think they should be talking about that. And then the other quick one, Larry, is up in Quetico when we canoe camp up there back in the 60s and 70s. If you were canoeing and casting along the shoreline, there'd be an eagle sitting in a tree. And as soon as you got near, that eagle would fly down the shoreline, roost in another tree. And as you canoed and fished down the shoreline, that eagle would get up and move farther down the shoreline. And it would repeat, and then he'd finally fly back to where he first came. Now, if you're canoeing up in an Quetico and you're fishing along the shoreline, it's pretty likely that an eagle, will come and sit in a tree where you're fishing and follow you down the shoreline, hoping for a free lunch. So,
well, that's one of the great experiences of being in the Quetico or a lot of other places. I've had certainly similar kinds of experiences when I've been out fishing myself. and have enjoyed it. Even watched an eagle kind of swimming to shore from a lake in northern Wisconsin. They land in lake, and Rich, they can swim.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch them swim, actually. I've seen, you can probably find video footage of that online pretty easily. But yeah, they're very adept swimmers and can manage that without a problem.
Yeah, I was surprised. The first time I saw that, I was concerned. I thought, oh, I wonder if the eagle's in trouble. I didn't go near it. I just watched it. And then you could see it. It knew what it was doing, for sure. And swam right up to the shoreline. Somebody else wonders, do bald eagles require federal and state protection, or do they have that yet?
Yeah, they still have federal protection. They were delisted in the state, so they're not state protected anymore. But they do have protection under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the federal Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, which protects the birds themselves, but also their nests and their young, and not only the active nests, but even older previous nests that they've used. And there's also some buffers around those nests for disturbance and other activities that might occur in proximity to where the eagles are nesting. So, yeah, they are definitely still protected at the federal level.
And somebody else wonders, is there any concern that the crowds coming to the event this weekend might spook the eagles or impact them in any way? And I think, Jenny, measures are taking that into account, are there not?
Yeah, you know, eagles, like the previous caller said, you know, eagles are individuals. So some of them are more sort of acclimatized to having people around, and some are not. And we do see that there is, one of the areas that's on our self-guided tour and one of the popular places for people to go and see eagles on their own is down actually at the hydroelectric dam. There's a parking area down there, and eagles quite often will perch in those trees right above the parking lot. And we do ask people to stay in their cars. Yeah. It's a great place to go and see eagles. But you can see them great from your car, and we do find that when people start getting out of their cars and slamming car doors, that quite often it'll spook those eagles, and they'll fly from those immediate trees and go up river or across the river. So they are easily spooked sometimes by people getting too close. So we try to limit that. The Overlook, we've never really had an issue with the Overlook. No. They don't typically come close enough for us to spook them right there, but it is something to be aware of, that if you see an eagle perched in a tree, will get,
they'll move.
especially a nest, don't approach a nest, don't approach an eagle, because you can spook them, and they're trying to conserve their energy in the cold, just like we do, so.
And one other email, are there other raptor species that people might see? I mean, are they there maybe in competition with the eagles? Rich?
This time of year, there's not a whole lot else there to be seen. There's probably like some resident red-tailed hawks that might fly by. One thing, I don't think they've been seen necessarily in that particular area, but there's also golden eagles now that come down in the wintertime and spend the winter in the driftless area of Wisconsin, especially. And this weekend is actually the golden eagle survey count that the National Eagle Center puts on. So that's also going on this weekend, and I'll be out counting eagles for that as well.
Well, Jenny and Rich, thank you both so much. It's this weekend. Saturday is the big day, I think. And I hope that you have a chance to get out there. Maybe you'll run into Jenny or maybe Rich while you're there. Jenny Lanzendorf heads the organizing committee for the days. And Rich Steffen, of course, zoologist and conservation biologist with the DNR. Great to have them with us. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.